Hi, I'm Liz Neerland with FISDAP's Open Airways, and today we are here with...
Sherm Severson.
And Ron Lawler.
And Ron and Sherm are going to tell us a bit about the Red River floods that happened up in Fargo and Moorhead last year. What do you guys want to tell us?
Well, my role during the 2009 and 2010 floods was primarily behind the scenes, and I functioned as a liaison officer, I guess you would call it, at both the Cass County, which is the county that Fargo, North Dakota is in, at their EOC, or Emergency Operations Center. And I was also, for a time, over at the Clay County EOC. So that was my main role. And the station, as a command center person, really the main role that I had was trying to get our frontline on the ground, paramedics, the resources they needed to do their job.
And Ron, what were you doing for the floods?
This last one wasn't too much. We didn't really have anything. It was just more prep type stuff. And the year before, when we actually did have evacuations and things, I first helped with getting the hospital evacuated, which was interesting to get a couple of hundred patients out of a hospital and get them all across the country. And I was in the command center for that, liaisoning between the hospital staff and the ambulance staff. And then when they came back, we had to bring the patients back. I was again in that same kind of role, which I think actually was harder, bringing the patients back, than it was getting rid of them.
Right. So set the scene for us. This is spring of 2009, right?
Correct.
And it was record. I mean, I think most of us remember hearing about it on the news, but it was huge record amounts of flooding from this river. So, I mean, what was it like on the ground? You knew it was coming. You were able to prepare for it. But as EMS professionals, what was it like?
You know, flood events are, I think people want to hear the word disaster. And when we drill for disasters, they tend to be the things that are, to borrow another medical phrase, acute. Things that happen immediately, a bus crash, a plane crashing. And we sometimes fail to realize that events like MCIs can unfold over a much longer period of time. In the case of a flood, several days. And there are points within that flood event that trigger certain activities by state officials, local officials, ambulance providers, fire services, county workers, utility workers. All those things occur at a much slower pace than when we, you know, typically think of a disaster, like a plane going down, and you need resources immediately. Floods you can plan for a little better, but there are inherent problems with that as well. As Ron mentioned, the evacuation of a hospital is a huge undertaking. Fortunately, during a flood event, it can be a little better planned for. And we brought in several other outside ambulance services to help throughout North Dakota, Minnesota, Canada, South Dakota.
You even had a couple from Montana that showed up.
Yep, I believe you're right. So it was an amazing thing. And at the end of the day, do you recall how many ambulances we had, Ron?
I think we had 109 or 110 ambulances altogether.
Different services that sent their vehicles.
And that's just to help evacuate hospital patients and that sort of thing, or was that for everything?
It was for everything. We had a long-term – people were there for days.
We actually got into a rotation cycle where we could put people at work and then put them down for rest schedules. And then as things were kind of tapering off, then we could send more people home and, you know, and they could send more from their home bases to replace them. So we had a kind of a rotation going. You know, you'd be here for 2-3 days and then you could go home. That was actually something that we didn't do very well for ourselves the first 2 or 3 days of the event. We had people that were up for 24 or 30 hours before we were like, you know, I think we need to give our own people some rest. And not necessarily even the street crew level crews, because they were getting their own rest cycle kind of. It was the support staff, the people in our kind of roles that mm-hmm. were going shift on. And it's like, you know, they're just not getting replaced because there isn't somebody enough depth in that position. People even just simply receiving food and supplies that were there for hours and hours before we got into that. And then this year, as we planned it, it was a little better. It was like, you know what, we made that mistake. This year we'll set it up with depth in those positions so that we don't get into the same problem. So it was awesome to see all the help that we got and to be able to use it in the manner that we did.
You know, along that line, Ron, I remember the first flood in 2009, which was a much worse event, both in the size of the flood, scope of the disaster, and urgency, because we didn't exactly know. We had never seen river levels this high. We didn't exactly know what we were getting into. But I remember, you know, Ron mentioned depth of, you need to have 2-3 people that can function in staging, in triage, in at the EOC, Emergency Operations Center, supplies, control and command, all these things. You need to have multiple people ready to work shifts. In the first flood, I worked 4 days in a row, about 16-hour shifts every single day. And I can tell you, I was not functioning well by that last shift. And it would have been better. The amount of energy you expend during a disaster, it's almost exponential compared to a normal call or a normal shift, because you're worried about so many other things. There's so many vehicles that you're in charge of, and you're trying to make sure that, you know, we talk about scene safety. When you have to account for 109 ambulances versus, you know, and when communications are down, I mean, difficult. It's very difficult.
It was kind of interesting, too. In 2009, they were trying to figure out how to do the staging of all those ambulances, and they really couldn't make it work on paper. They eventually went with a Post-it note on a wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, computer program wasn't working.
Yeah, because they just couldn't do it on the fly. So they had Post-it notes for each truck on the wall of where it was from, how many people were in it, and what skill levels they were. And then they would move it from, you know, in service to out for rest to awaiting the next call. And then this year they spent the last year figuring out, well, that's really not a great plan because we can't document it and it's difficult to plan with that. So they made their own program to plan with. And then, you know, we've done some drills now where we've used that database basically to run the stuff, and it works well.
Mm-hmm. But that assumes you have power.
Well, we do have a lot of generators, right. So that was good.
Yeah.
But it was just kind of funny in 09, and, you know, everything's wet, it's raining, you're freezing, you walk into this trailer, which is where staging was, and the entire wall is 4 different colors of Post-it notes. This is a well-run operation, you know?
Yeah, it was coded, and it was simple, and had we lost power, it was still working, it was functional, it was constantly updated on the fly. You know, one of the things that I recall particularly, you know, you mentioned all these Post-it notes. We had a staging area full of ambulances, and we dealt with probably the biggest enemy was boredom for most of the providers, because people are very eager to come and help with a disaster. And I think they have a misconception that it's going to be, frankly, a bit fun or you know, this is what we got into EMS
exciting.
For. Yeah,
right.
Exciting. And here they show up, and the river's inching up by hour. I mean, it's not an event like water's rolling down the streets and stranding people. They were building dikes 24/7. They filled, I can't even tell you how many sandbags. It was
millions
of sandbags. And
It was waiting for the trip points, the trigger points.
Yeah.
And the city or the county engineer would say, okay, we're going to leave this area of town alone because the water is only going to get this high. Well, then the prediction would change, or it would start raining again. And they'd say, okay, now we got to evacuate this area. And boom, we'd need 6 trucks to go right now to pick up, you know, the disabled population or the at-risk population or a nursing home. And we had several nursing home evacuations, too, that it was.
We evacuated every nursing home, didn't we?
And eventually,
Fargo and Moorhead.
Tell us what those were like.
Ron has real good firsthand experience on the ground with.
Well, with the hospital mainly, but the you know, from watching the nursing home ones that I was, it was something that was easier to plan because we'd get a little more notice and we'd have enough vehicles there. And again, it was using people from out of town because they were excited about it and get them in there. And we have a pretty good MCI team, and this is pretty much their deal. So getting in and the staff is very helpful. And again, it was more, where do they go? You know, you show up with your truck, you can load people into it, but then what? And so the coordinating with the drivers and things was probably the hardest thing, I think, for most of the people on the ground was.
Well, and figuring out where to take a patient that needs X level of care.
That's right. Exactly right.
When you're probably, the place that's flooding is the place that has the highest level of care available in the area.
Yeah, right. You need to get them. You don't just move them from a nursing home. You need to move them from a level of care to another equivalent level of care. And that occurred, those types of pre-planning occurred behind the scenes at the public health nurses and the, I mean, that planning was done prior to moving people. Again, had the dikes been breached, then we would have had a catastrophic evacuation. Then it wouldn't have mattered. We would have just moved people as fast as we could to areas of higher, you know, literally higher ground, and then staged them. That would have been a two-staged event, and then moved them once we had spots for them. But nursing homes and hospitals throughout, in fact, we went as far away as, we went down to Minneapolis, and from Fargo, that's, you know, nearly 300 miles.
And Bismarck, we were, Bismarck, the hospital right. evacuation was much worse, actually, because they kept trying to delay it. And I was in the command center at the time, and, you know, you don't want to move all these critical patients if you don't have to, or even the non-critical patients. And so the management was, you know, we can make it, we can stay in place, until it was finally, you know, if we lose this lower dike, we're going to lose the building. And so we don't have any choice anymore. And so then it was boom, boom, and you had to go. And then to find places to take an ICU patient, you can't just drive them to the clinic in some small town. You got to take them to an ICU that's equivalent. And if they have to be lower or higher elevation than you, so driving them from Fargo to Grand Forks, which is downriver from us, doesn't make any sense.
Because it's going to get high there, right. too, the water.
And that's the closest ICU to us, so now they're off limits. So we had trucks that were doing 7-8 hour, 9 hour round trips to take patients from Fargo to Grand Forks, to Bismarck, I mean, or to Minneapolis, and then back again to get more. So it was, and the weather was not good. And in fact, a few times we had crews that would get out to wherever they were going and had to stop and wait until it was got enough so you could just see the road and make your way back to town to pick up more people.
Yeah, we had during, not only did we have rising water, we had a big snowstorm in the middle of it, which made life really miserable. So you take resources that you know you need for dike building, and now those payloaders have to be moved to the city streets just to clear paths off so law enforcement can still get through. National Guard.
We were coordinating with the Guard as well, yeah. because we were riding. We would put medics in their Humvees because our ambulances couldn't get places.
Yeah. Especially with the high water. I mean, those vehicles could navigate
right.
2-3 feet of water where your ambulance can't do that.
Right. Or even on the 5-ton dump trucks a couple of times because the Humvee couldn't get through. So it was quite a coordination between all of that going on at the same time.
You know, one of the things that I particularly recall at the EOC, at the Emergency Operations Center, was there is a certain degree, and I suppose it's inherent to the way our government functions, but there's a little degree of disconnect between local officials and state officials. One night, I remember we were trying to get a hold of state officials, and they had gone home at 5 o'clock. For them, it wasn't an immediate, and maybe they didn't realize how bad this event could get, but it was odd to us. You know, we're having a disaster, and just a few miles away, I guess 100 miles away or so, we have state officials that we kind of were counting on, and they got difficult to get a hold of. But whose fault is that? It probably was somewhat our own for not telling them, hey, you know, we really need you there. Governments are reluctant to spend money during any disasters. We've found that out. I mean, there was resources literally across the river in Moorhead that were not allowed to go into North Dakota, even though we needed them. And that was at the state level. It would have had to been requested by local officials and then worked its way through the state officials. And by the time, sometimes the bureaucracy runs a little slower than you need it to.
It's like you hear the stories of in New Orleans where they,
yeah.
you know, the National Guard didn't roll out in one state, but it did in another because the yes. mayor didn't ask for it. So then the city couldn't ask for it. So the county couldn't ask for it. So the state couldn't
yeah.
send them, even exactly. though they were ready to go. I mean, you have these, the disaster is obvious, but yeah. you still have bureaucracy. Paperwork.
You know what? That is, you know, that's interesting. Ron brings up paperwork because of all the things that we probably did wrong in that first flood, paperwork was probably one of the biggest. And people, you know, I tell students.
There was too much paperwork or you didn't do it right? Or
there is definitely too much. having those sheets available in front of you at the time that you need them, rather than retroactively trying to fill them out, you need to keep track of who was there, what hours they logged, because you'll get some of that reimbursed by state officials and national, federal
FEMA,
officials.
Yeah.
Yeah, by FEMA. But you've got to follow the rules. Mm-hmm. And we had people showing up who called themselves strike teams, for example, and they weren't. I mean, they just kind of self-described themselves that
right.
way. And the reason they did that is because the reimbursement was different for them.
Right.
You know, people will manipulate the system at times. So you have to watch out for that. And you have to know exactly what you're requesting and what you need. And then the documentation needs to follow.
Or, I mean, even if it seems, sure, there's equipment just across the river and we need it.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, taxpayer money pays for that bulldozer. You have
one
to be
way
able
or another.
To track and inventory your equipment and supplies. And,
yeah. and justify your need for it.
Right.
Even
so what did you guys learn? What lessons did you take from 09?
Is critical. And mm-hmm. For students, here, the one thing that I'd pass on if I was a student, and to all of our students, we tell them that these MCIs, they need to function under incident command. So all those tests that they take online, FEMA tests and related to ICS 100 and 700 and 200, all of those tests, when they're doing them, people always complain about them. But during an actual event, everybody needs to know that stuff, because if you're not on the same sheet of music, playing a different tune than somebody else, confusion sets in. So as annoying as some of those classes may seem when you're taking them, they work. And they work well when everybody's following it.
And I think, too, that, you know, as an overarching thing, that's probably true. But there was a lot of things we learned that were right on the ground that were you didn't even think about. Like you mentioned boredom, you know, and you've got 100 crews in a one-block area with nothing to do. You need to find them something to do. And EMS people will find things to do that aren't necessarily what you want.
They're not constructive.
Right, not constructive. So we lucked out that the local Walmart and Target stores actually donated video games for us.
Xboxes.
Right,
with
right.
flat-screen TVs yeah. and everything. It was really good. And we would have never thought of that. It would have never been something.
Right.
Even just having a deck of cards would have been something that would have been helpful. And you wouldn't even think of that. We're concerned about, you know, thousands of diesel fuel gallons. Mm-hmm. We're concerned about number of trucks. When in reality, to keep those people interested and there and, you know, available for the next call, we needed to have something for them to do as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so many station duties. Even when there's 100 people there, you can't mop the floors many times. So finding them recreational things was mm-hmm. actually a pretty important thing to do.
And I suppose from a mental health perspective,
sure.
too, you know.
And that's not on any of the ICS stuff. They don't talk about that on there. So it was those kind of things, too, that I think we learned, you know, how to make a better system for tracking and that kind of thing that we figured out that you can't figure out until you actually do it. You know, when you do an MCI drill, you don't have people sitting around waiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're doing. You know, you do MCI drills in an arena. You do them on the airport. You don't do a flood MCI
during
drill.
During nice weather.
Yeah. You don't have people hanging out for a drill for 4, 5, 6 days.
Right.
You know, that'd be a great paycheck. But
would be.
Well, it seems like a flood is a very unique situation, that it's one of the few disasters that requires such a huge scale of response, but also unfolds so slow. I mean, even
it's
forest
a slow
fire
mover.
Is quick.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
even if it takes
as long
several
as
days.
The dikes don't breach, it's a slow mover. And
well, even if the time frame is totally different. You know, you think about a tornado, it comes through, mm-hmm. it damages, it's done, you bulldoze, you start over. In a flood, if nothing happens, great, you sit around for a couple of days, and then you go home again. But if the dikes breach or it floods over, now you got to wait for the water to recede. Now you've got cleanup for several weeks. You can't go back into basements for maybe a year afterwards because of the mold and everything else.
Yeah.
So it's such a long-term event. And if you've evacuated, now you got to reintegrate everybody back into the community. And that was when I was back in the hospital, getting people back into the building, it took us longer to bring back less people than to get rid of them, because now you had to coordinate with different agencies and with the hospital that has them doesn't necessarily want to give them up now,
right,
you know, and families don't necessarily want to bring them back, and so then you have to negotiate all that, and it took us a lot longer to get them back into town. And even moving nursing homes and things back, we lost a lot of resources because the urgency is gone. So all those people that were volunteers showed up to help with the disaster, but then they're gone. So to move a nursing home with one truck takes a lot longer than with 14.
Right.
So it draws it out even longer. And, you know, you're paying for that event for a lot longer than, you know, if the building was blown over and they had to build a new one, you'd just find somewhere else to go.
I would also say that during the actual flood event, when you're certainly there is a distinction between evacuating and emergency, you know, or evacuation and or transferring people out. I don't know what exactly I'm trying to say, but the
planned versus emergent.
Yeah, the urgency of it allows you to do things differently than you would, you know, you would normally get a good patient history, and you would have the patient's charts there, and you would move them, and it'd be very deliberate. You'd know exactly where you're going right away. During the evacuation, you just get told where you're going to go, and you might not even know what's wrong with the patient. They might just say they have dementia and good luck.
And that even came up when you mentioned charts. You know, we're moving all these patients out of a hospital or a nursing home. How do you transport a chart that's kept in a cabinet? Mm-hmm. Because there's so many pieces to it. You know, if you've got a nursing home patient that's been there for 10 years, they've got feet of chart. How do you take that with in an ambulance? Or it's all electronic. How do you give that to somebody to take with them?
Right. Or how do you, you know, track one patient going over here and one patient going over there, and they're all in the same file drawer, but...
You know, we didn't lose anybody, which actually was a big worry.
Which is good.
It happened during Katrina. They lost people, mm-hmm. meaning, you know, they found them way after the fact in a nursing home. Nobody even knew anything about them. We didn't lose anything. No loss of life other than those that were already in hospice care, which is another little takeaway. You have not only the people in nursing homes and hospitals, there's a significant number of people, shut-ins, that you may not even think about. Everybody that was in hospice care, they kind of have their own little mini hospital in their own homes. At any one time, there can be several hundred people in hospice care. There can be people that are living in assisted living facilities that don't need care every single day, 24 hours a day, but certainly need a degree of help. Those people got a little bit lost in the initial shuffle. We found them, and no harm came to them eventually, but it produced some real problems because the nurses in the hospitals were home sandbagging their own houses. Mm-hmm. So staffing
the home health nurses
issues.
And the assisted living nurses and the, you know, these at-risk populations that are social living at home,
workers.
You know, all the people that would work with them weren't available because they're, you know, they're not all in one building. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they're in small homes all over town, and then you transport them and to a gym somewhere, and now you've got issues because you've got all these people in this one place now that when they're individuals, it's not necessarily a big deal. You drop in, you visit them once a day, now it's not a big deal. Now you've got 50 of them in a gymnasium floor.
And they're cranky. And cots are not easy to sleep
on. No.
And they're not used to being around people, and they've all got issues of some kind or another. And there's one, two, three caregivers there when it's just not good.
And I would think it's hard too for, you know, for you to be sitting there at base and waiting for to help,
can't do
worrying
anything.
About your house.
Oh, that's
right.
A good point.
I mean, I think you kind of touched on the caregivers aren't there because they're sandbagging their own house. But how hard is it to be sitting there, saving the city, saving the patients, when your own family might be in danger or your own house, your own property?
You know, some people were affected by the flood. I had. I live far enough away from the river on the Moorhead, Minnesota side that I heard the projections, and every time for about 3 days in a row there, the National Weather Service guys were the biggest enemies in the EOC. Mm-hmm. Every time they opened their mouth, it was disaster looming, and it got worse and worse and worse. And then we weren't going to have enough sandbags. I mean, they predicted that. They predicted a breach. They predicted 43 or 44 feet, and that would have... At 45 feet, I had water in my basement. At 44, I was fine. So when I heard that projection, it could get 45, 46 feet, I called my wife and, you know, I tried to explain to her how to take a toilet off in the basement. And I ended up just, you know, I helped her out eventually. I did get some time off. I went home and I shoved a football half deflated down into the hole where my toilet used to be. And then I put a 2x6 beam from the floor holding the football into the roof or to the floor joist above it. And it just looks comical, but it's.
Why do you remove a toilet? So it can't flood up the sewage system?
Exactly. Well, once the water table gets so high, and then if you lose your sanitary sewer, now your basement's going to be full of more than just clean water.
Yeah, it's some not just people, river water.
Yeah, some people were flooding their own basements
with
clean water to try to keep the bad water out.
Luckily for me, in my house was a little higher up in Fargo, and so it'd have to get pretty high to get my house too, but if you lose a sewer, you're still going to be messed up. Mm-hmm. In 2000, I actually did lose a sewer and had a basement full of my neighbor's things. And so I put in a knife valve. So all I had to do was shut the knife valve off. So I just called home and said, close the valve, and then I don't have to worry about the toilets. But still, if it comes overland, it's going to come in my windows anyway.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a concern but for us. And
stuff
so I,
you don't think about.
You know, and luckily, I had two kids at home. So I'm like, you know, start carrying everything upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there was, we did have some staff that went home for a couple of days to make sure their stuff was safe before they came back to work. So it's something you need to think about.
One of the things I recall, you know, we had a lot of FEMA people coming in, and many of these officials had worked the Katrina hurricane, Hurricane Rita and Hurricane Katrina. And it was a bit comical for what I call us flatlanders there in the Red River Valley to hear these guys talking. They were talking, you know, they had these bullet points on this little presentation, and they were telling us to make sure to check attics and, you know, for survivors if the dike breached. And it was really weird to hear that because, you know, we wouldn't have been in the situation New Orleans was. And mm-hmm. people don't, I mean, they would have had more time to mm-hmm. get out than they did in New Orleans and wouldn't have been hiding in the attics. But that was weird. I mean, that was one of the things that I recall. Everybody kind of looked at each other across the room and kind of had this sheepish grin like, you know what? We're not going to have people in the attics. They're just going to have to get out of the town. And
they weren't really familiar with basements either.
No, they weren't. They didn't. That was really, yeah. I mean, that was true. They didn't understand the concept. You mean everybody's got a basement up here? And just about, you know.
Pretty much.
Unless you're in a trailer home. Yeah.
And the trailers float, so you're okay there.
Yeah. Agreed. Some of the other things we ran into, probably the worst night for me, at about 3 in the morning, we got a call from one of the shelters outside of town. They had moved many of these assisted living people that I had mentioned earlier. They moved them out to a smaller town about not quite 20 miles away from Fargo. And they had moved them, and they had taken these people, and many of them didn't have their wheelchairs with them. They didn't have their walkers, didn't have their medications, didn't have the things that they needed, you know, insulin, daily activity items that you use every day, toothpaste, toothbrush. I mean, all of the things that we take for granted normally day to day, they didn't have with them. And one of the deputies had stopped by based on a phone call from a nurse that was helping watch this group of about somewhere between 80 to 100 people. And she was in tears on the phone. I remember talking to her. And then the deputy got on and said that she was out there, and she said, we have to get these people out of this shelter because the bathrooms are plugged up, they're overflowing, and it just was a horrible situation for the care workers there. Three people trying to take care of 80. It was near riot, according to the sheriff's deputy. So what we ended up doing is sending out a secondary team to assess it, and then we started moving people again. To places even, I guess, farther away than they already were, 60, 70 miles away versus just 20. You kind of have to think three steps ahead. The people that are going to help you are going to be within your 50-mile radius normally. But what happens when those people also have towns going underwater? And that's what happened to us. We couldn't use the people 20 miles away. We had to go to the cities, Minneapolis. We had to go to Bismarck, to Langdon, to all these places that were far, far away from Fargo because everybody else around us was flooding too.
Benefit of living on flat land.
Yes. Our ancestors, not too bright.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us your stories of the floods.
You bet.
You are welcome.
Open Airways podcasts are produced by FISDAP with support from EMSresponder.com. All recordings express the opinions and experience of the speaker and do not constitute legal or medical advice. This and other recordings can be found at www.openairways.net.